thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we focus on our birds. Bill Volkert back with me. Bill, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He's worked, he did work at Horican Marsh, did it for 27 years, has been watching birds for well over 40, and so he's here to help you. What birds are you seeing in your area? What questions do you have about feeding birds, perhaps? Join the conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us with your questions or maybe your bird photos. We always love to see those. Just go to ideas@wpr.org for that. And Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Always great to be here.
You know, Bill, here's a song that we are probably going to be hearing, my guess, in maybe a month and a half or so. Let's listen.
That is the house finch.
The house finch.
And that's the true song, which we'll hear in the late winter, springtime. They'll start tuning up already.
Yeah. What do we hear now? Do we hear anything now from the...
Those are the call notes, and those are the contact calls and warning calls that birds will do throughout the year. The true song is in establishing their territory in preparation for nesting. But a lot of the winter residents will actually start to tune up a little bit as we get that winter thaw at late January, mid-February, a nice sunny day. We'll start to hear the first cardinal singing, maybe the chickadees actually going to the song, which is that little two-note pee-wee, rather than a chickadee-dee-dee and other little chatters they'll do. So some of these birds will start, as I always refer to it, as sort of tuning up well before the nesting season. And it's kind of nice, you know, and it gets a little long in wintertime, get a sunny day, and then hear some birds making a little bit of noise. Usually, I think of the very first ones as we get into late January, and by mid-February, we'll start to hear various birds start to chime in.
It's wonderful. And I tell you what, it makes the jog or the run in the morning in springtime so much fun. It's along about 5:30 and 6, they start... They're already starting in, and you get a little melody while you're on your run. I love that.
Well, and that's the nice thing about birds and watching them is that you can find them anywhere.
Yeah.
I think that's what's made it so appealing. It doesn't matter where you live or where you travel. Birds can be found anywhere on the planet.
Let's, Diane in La Crosse has something that I think relates to all this. Diane, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, we have a continual visitor that's staying this winter with us. It's a Carolina wren.
Mm. Lucky you. Carolina wren is the largest of our wrens in the eastern United States, and Wisconsin is a little north of the normal nesting range. The last, almost decade or so, we've seen an increase in the number of sightings, particularly in the southern part of the state. They're very random where they're showing up. But it does seem as becoming a little bit more frequent, and I understand you've got the birds still there during the wintertime. We do occasionally have some winter records of birds sticking around. So they're not a real long-distance migrant, and as I say, we're just a little far north of the normal range, but it seems as if we're starting to see an increased frequency of sightings in Wisconsin.
So now what would Diane, if she wants to do some feeding, what would that Carolina wren like?
They will take suet. They're not really a seed eater, but, when you get desperate, anything will do. But, suet is something that they will certainly take advantage of. It's a good high fat content for them, and that helps to get them by.
Yeah. Diane, and it made a nest in a hanging basket?
It made one this year, and it made one probably 2 years earlier. So she skipped us. There, but we were really fun. It was really fun watching her and her little fledglings leave the nest and listening to the calls. There's so many different calls that they do. It's
very loud, and the little mnemonic for that is a tea kettle, tea kettle, a very fast little chatter, a little rolling song that they do in spring, summertime.
Tyler, have we got that? Have we got a Carolina wren anywhere? I'll have you look around and see if you can find it. And while you're doing that, you can also push the button to put Randall from Schultzberg on the line. Randall, hi.
Hi, Hi, yeah, I just want to mention I saw a snowy owl down here yesterday, just a little bit outside of town.
Very nice. Snowy owls are, of course, a bird coming out of the Arctic. We tend to have some sightings throughout Wisconsin every year. And then every, say, 4 to 5 years, we tend to get an influx of them when the lemming population crashes up in the Arctic. And so when food runs short, they come down here. We had a nice influx of them the last winter. This year is a little bit slower. It seems that the snowy owl production was not as good this year, though the lemmings are still remain low. So they didn't produce a lot of young, but there isn't an abundance of food up there. And the last I checked on December 2nd, there were 43 sightings of snowy owls in Wisconsin.
Very
reported
cool.
From 26 counties. The best places to see them, they like something that looks like the big open tundra, very large open windswept areas. So around Portage County, that Buena Vista Marsh area, that's always good. Around the Horicon Marsh and some of the surrounding farmland. So central Wisconsin is a good place for them. And also up toward Green Bay and along Lake Michigan front, where they'll sometimes even hunt ducks along the lakefront. Those are some of the better places to look for them.
Hey, Randall, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate
always
it very much.
Always a great bird to see.
It's a wonderful bird to see. Well, let's go back to the Carolina Wren for a minute. Tyler, have we got the Carolina Wren?
There you go.
There we go. That's the Carolina Wren.
As I said, the little mnemonic help you remember that pattern or rhythm. Tea kettle is the most common one. So a bird that's not that common in Wisconsin in summertime, but they have been showing up more. It's a bird I keep waiting for my backyard bird list. I'd like to add that one. There's any better chance of seeing it at some point.
Well, let's go to Betsy in River Falls next. Betsy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My original question was, and I still want to ask it, is we have lots of starlings, and they haven't migrated yet. I mean, lots and lots of starlings are flying in clouds. It's kind of amazing. But the other question is, does anyone yet know what the crow sound that sounds kind of like a laugh means?
Yeah, that little kind of a chuckle, little rolling call. I believe that that's actually the song. I can't say that definitively, but it is a particular vocalization that we only hear at a certain time of year. They're kind of reserved with it. So I think that may actually serve as the true song, part of the mating and courtship for them.
Is their courtship?
They're actually a pretty early nester. Ravens and crows will start to build their nests in March already. So they'll start quite early in the year.
Yeah, there you go,
and
Betsy.
Being, of course, generalists as far as the food that they're looking for, as soon as the snow melts, generalists like them, food's available and accessible, so they can start pretty early in the year.
All right. Thanks, Betsy. Appreciate it. And by the way, you can join in, too, with your own questions or comments, or maybe you got an experience to share. Love to hear them at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us your question and maybe your bird photo at ideas@wpr.org. Jason in Menominee up next. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Larry. I was just going to tell a story about some woodpeckers. I was staring out the window, and I saw a woodpecker land, and I asked the fellow what kind it was, and he said that he didn't know whether it was a hairy or a downy woodpecker because they look so similar.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said one was larger than the other, but he'd never probably get the chance to compare them. And as I was gazing out the window, another one landed, and it was probably about 3/4 of the size. But looking
oh, there you go, side by side.
Yeah, so I guess that maybe I got lucky, or maybe that happens all the time, but that's the whole story.
Well, thank you, Jason. And you'll see hairies and downies.
Yes, they're very common anywhere you've got some trees, even in the city's parks, they may show up. Downy woodpeckers by far more abundant than the hairy, which is a slightly larger cousin. And for identification hints, if you're looking at them from a distance, your downy woodpecker is about 5.5 inches in length. Hairy is 7. Well, that's only a slight difference.
Yeah.
And if you're looking from, say, 50 yards or more away, that might be hard to determine. Best identification hint is look at the bill. The downy woodpecker has a small, short bill that's about half the length of the distance across the head. where the hairy woodpecker, much more substantial bill, it is about as long as the head is across.
There you go.
So that'll help you quickly identify them.
Thank you, Jason. Appreciate it. And Lisa in McFarland, your turn. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Yeah, I have something very, very strange going on. I have an Oriole that's decided to stay.
A Baltimore Oriole.
A Baltimore Oriole. Looks like a immature male, probably from this year. I feed birds. I have a lot of feeders out, so I have a lot of birds. And when I identified him and sent pictures to birding friends of mine, and they all said it's an Oriole. I've been giving him I put jelly out, which he just loved. And now I've started putting live mealworms out, which he's also eating. He seems healthy. He seems to be doing just fine.
But he shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
Yeah, we also have a note here that someone else reported a female rose-breasted grosbeak. Now, Baltimore Oriole should be in Central America right now.
Yes.
And a rose-breasted grosbeak should be anywhere from Central America all the way into Colombia, South America. So the rest of the birds all left. Why these individuals remain, that's always hard to say. Was it something in the physiology? They just didn't get the signal to migrate as the instinct should have triggered it? Or perhaps was there something about their condition that was compromised? We're not really quite sure. But we do get these stragglers, that birds that'll stick around. Nice that somebody can help them out, because those birds need a little bit more assistance to be able to get by, because their normal food is gone, which is why they migrate.
Mm-hmm.
So, your mealworms and your jelly, whatever you can do to help them out, that'd be great. Yeah. We also right now have some other unusual sightings in Wisconsin. There is a report of a Hammond's flycatcher, which is a western flycatcher.
Yeah.
That's down in Iowa County. A few birders have gone down to see that. And here's a bird that snatches flying insects out of the air. There's apparently some open water nearby, but I'm sure it's getting a little stressed, getting kind of hard to find enough food for it, but it seems to be getting by. And then also I saw yesterday a report of a white-eyed vireo here in the Madison area. And these are distinctly summer birds. The Hammond's flycatcher shouldn't even be here. It's a western bird. Why they're here and what happened, hard to say. I also have to question, is there any change in bird behavior that we're getting more and more of these reports? Or is it just simply that people are watching more closely and have so many more resources where to check? So, and I think that's probably more the case, as we've got more experienced bird watchers out there, or for people who may not be that familiar with the birds, that they at least have some resource to turn to question something that's unusual. And I think we're just getting better coverage of some of these anomalies of these birds that are remaining around. The other question I also have is, if they're sticking around now and perhaps weren't in the best physical condition, all of a sudden one day they disappear. Are they able to build up the reserves take off and make up for that lost time, or do they just freeze off the perch one night? We really don't know. So it's fascinating to have these sightings and reports coming in, what these birds are really doing, so out of the normal schedule or even out of their normal range, that still remains a mystery. But that's the fun of watching birds. You never know what's going to show up.
Thanks so much, Lisa, for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Great to have him with us today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the birds that are we're experiencing here in Wisconsin right now. Some of them kind of an unusual sightings with our guest today, Bill Volkert. Retired wildlife DNR educator. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in. And speaking of thanks, I want to give you a big thanks for all who contributed during our year-end membership drive. You donated more than $375,000. We had 2,350 listeners pledging, and we're glad to welcome 425 new members to the WPR family. So it's really great. And if you missed the drive, still join in with your donation at WPR.org. It certainly helps us ensure a strong future. But thanks so much for your contributions. If you have questions, every one of our lines is filled right now. So I won't give you the number. I was going to give you the number again, but why give it right now? Instead, let's go to Natalie in Toma.
Hello.
Hi, Natalie.
Hi. Hey, I've got a question here about our lone sandhill crane. We live up here in Toma, and 3 weeks ago, the pastures and the creek were full of cranes flocking, and they're all gone except one. And I'm just wondering, is it going to head south on its own, or is it here to stay for the duration, or will she survive, or what?
Yeah, it almost sounds like if it missed the train and everybody else took off, that perhaps it's got a bit of a problem, injury or something.
Yeah.
I noticed with sandhill cranes this year, at least from my limited view of the flocks going over my house and neighborhood, it seemed like they departed a little bit earlier because of the quick freeze-up that we had. I know there were some large flocks in a few other locations, a little more prime habitat for them in Wisconsin. Most of them are going down to at least Tennessee. The main destination for our flock is the southern Georgia, north Florida, but they'll scatter anywhere between there, depending on the weather conditions and how much snow cover. We will get some cranes that we can stick around into the winter, but the big thing is the amount of snow on the ground. So right now, we don't have a real heavy blanket of snow in most of the state, so food should be accessible. But most of those birds tend to leave in anticipation of the coming of that winter.
Yeah.
Since for them to stick around the whole year, it's pretty unlikely most winters there will be food. Others like Canada geese, they can usually find food and they're pretty tough. They'll stick around right to the last minute, and if a storm rolls in, they'll fly out right ahead of that.
All right.
But yeah, most of the cranes should be gone by now.
Thank you, Natalie.
We'll
appreciate
see how
your
that
call.
One does.
Yeah, you never know what's going to happen there. Kathleen in Fifield, it's your turn. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello, Larry. Listen to your guest there. I'm really stumped. I haven't seen evening grosbeaks in my yard now for several years. I have a bunch of them close to 40. It started out about 10 and then 20, and now I've got about 40 that show up every morning, and they're eating my safflower. And I'm just stumped. I have not seen them for so long. Do they stay around during the winter?
Yes, it is a winter finch. And, well, first of all, populations in Canada have been declining, and we're not quite sure why. Say about two, 3 decades ago, we had much larger populations, not only the breeding population up in Canada, but much larger influxes of those birds coming into Wisconsin. It's been more infrequent lately. This is a fair year for evening grosbeaks, and like a lot of our winter finches, it's based on food availability. And the cone production in Canada has been rather poor this summer. So lack of food, they expect a somewhat moderate chance of influx of evening grosbeaks, a better chance of some of the other finches, especially purple finch and red, the common red pole. Interestingly, I get a report out of Ontario from the Ministry of Natural Resources. There's a fellow up there, Ron Pittaway, and he sort of surveys all the experts across Ontario, and they look at the seed production of mostly the conifers, so the hemlock, the spruces, pines,
yeah,
and then also the birches, which are little catkins, which is a favorite food for the pine siskin and especially the red pole. And they look at that from year to year, and when we get a poor production of one or the other kind of species of tree, it's a selected food for certain kinds of finches. And that usually indicates the good opportunity for a big influx. So crossbills are probably not coming in huge numbers this year, but evening grosbeaks somewhat moderate, but it looks like it's a pretty good year for the siskins and red poles. I have not seen any of those at my feeder, but with the lack of snow cover out, there's a lot of just wild seed available for them. So I think if they're in Wisconsin, they're probably scattered across the countryside. We'll get a better picture of that when the Christmas bird counts come up. They're starting this weekend. So when we get these masses of birders going out in these areas and actually surveying the birds, it gives us a better indication of what's out there, not just at your feeder, but across the countryside.
And by the way, Kathleen, thank you so much for calling the Christmas bird count. Let's talk a bit more about that before we take some more calls. By
Definitely.
The way, there's open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. Call in. We'll get you on pretty quickly. But what about that Christmas bird count?
Well, Christmas bird count is an annual tradition. It is actually considered to be the oldest bird survey in the world. It grew out of an old tradition from back in the late 1800s, where the gentlemen, after their Christmas dinner, would go out with their small shotguns and would shoot birds and have a contest. So you could shoot the most number and greatest variety, because at that time, there wasn't really a concern over conservation. We just assumed that all wildlife was just absolutely unlimited in its numbers, and there would always be more than enough, and we couldn't even put a dent in them. With the disappearance of the passenger pigeon, with the concern over great egrets adorning ladies' hats, and out of this grew that conservation movement, a lot of attention toward conserving wildlife started. And so it was in the year 1900 that Ludlow Griscom originally came up with the idea of, well, rather than shooting and killing birds, why don't we count them? And why don't we take a closer look? And so with that, it began as a very local tradition, has grown nationwide, and now throughout Canada and the Americas. And it gives us a really good feel for bird numbers and their distribution in wintertime. It's conducted within a count circle. So there's a designated area. It's 15 miles in diameter, and people divide that up into different sections, and we have counting parties, individuals or groups of people who go out, and for one designated day in a count circle, we'll go out and look for birds. So it always starts in mid-December, goes into early January. And so with that, the Christmas bird count, we've got almost 100 of them in Wisconsin. And it's also a nice chance for people to get out and enjoy birds. And if you're never have really participated in a bird count, it's a great time to get started. Yeah. Because first of all, you can get together with somebody else who knows the territory of where they're going to cover an area. Many of these people have done the same places, the same little section year after year. And you also have somebody with some experience of identifying the birds. It's not that confusing, because a good day you'll get about 25 to 40 species, compared to, say, in May, where we're overwhelmed with the variety, and it can be a little bit intimidating for a beginner. And so it's a chance to be able to get a little more familiar with the common birds and maybe sight some of the more unusual ones or things you might not have ever seen before. And if anybody's interested in participating in a Christmas bird count, it's an easy way to do it. Go to the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology website. It's wsobirds.org. And you get to the homepage, just look in the upper right-hand corner. You'll see a couple little links up there. CBC, Christmas Bird Count. Click on that, a window opens up, and you'll see by county all of the counts and the day that they're done, and there'll be the contact person for that. And just simply take a look at the county where you're going to be.
Yeah, you don't have to be an expert either.
Oh, no, and it's a great time to get together with somebody who is and be able to share the experience with them and bring your family along as well.
Yeah, that's a great experience for sure. Well, we have many callers online again, so Scott in Appleton, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for the show. I appreciate the time and all the advice. I've been in the background locating for quite some time. I wanted to call in because in April we had a record snowfall within 3 days of all of our robins arriving, and we had just decimated populations of robins throughout the state.
Yeah, definitely. So it's quite serious.
I saw almost no robins this year, but I saw a lot of monarch butterflies. So number one, is there a correlation? Number two, is there going to be a rebound? Do you think that the robins are going to come back? I mean, eventually they would, but really back in the kind of numbers we expect. So that's my question. I'll take my answer offline.
All right. Thank you, Scott.
Well, most bird or animal populations in general are really determined by the quality of the habitat. And robin's quite a generalist. It also has adapted very well to human-modified environments. So as far as robins are concerned, there is more than enough habitat available for them. And wildlife populations tend to grow to a point of the limits of the resources. So we've always had a lot of robins. Yes, you're right. That April storm was just devastating to the population, because they were quite vulnerable at that time, and the snow just covered up the food supply. And birds that were already stressed and migrating to arrive here all of a sudden found themselves really out of luck, and it had a serious impact on the number of robins. I know a number of people have already written in and say that.
Yeah, Marilyn and Beaver Dam and Bruce and Maribel both had
very common
the
theme.
Same.
What you're probably noticing, I think like most people, are the pairs of robins in your own backyard. So if we, say, cut a population down by a very large percentage, of those robins that arrived here ready to nest, and we lost a large percentage of those. We not only had a much more of a decrease in the density of birds, but probably neighborhoods that didn't have any, or maybe one where you had multiple pairs. But of course, those that did nest are rebuilding those populations, and within a year or two, I think we'll be back more or less where we were. They'll recover fairly quickly, but it's those freak storms like that that can be really quite devastating for wildlife populations.
Probably not. No relationship between that and the monarchs.
No, I don't think that robins as really being in any way a predator on them. In fact, the monarchs take the toxins into their system from the milkweed plants that they eat as caterpillars, so birds tend to avoid them. And so it wasn't any lack of predation pressure, just coincidental that robins got hit hard and looked like monarchs did fairly well this year.
Let's move on. By the way, we had, I don't know if you can see these on the screen, Marty emailed a beautiful shot of a Carolina wren. If you can see it, you may have mm-hmm. to. And then Greta in Fish Creek emailed this photo. She says she has no idea what this bird is. It's guarding the berry trees even during a snowstorm. A buff color.
Yeah, so where is she located?
Fish Creek, so Fish Door County Creek. Area.
That's Townsend Solitaire.
Townsend Solitaire.
It's another western bird. It's in the thrush family. And we do have a population that actually migrates to the east and shows up almost every single year at the Baraboo Bluffs.
Ah.
And I just saw a report the other day. Somebody did a little hiking out there and found them. They usually hang around the cedar trees where they're eating on the berries. So here's a bird that is an abundant population. You get out from Colorado west, you'll see Townsend Solitaire quite abundant and quite widespread. But here in Wisconsin, it's a very infrequent visitor. The Baraboo Hills is like the only reliable place, and you might have enough birds to count on one hand there in any year. And then randomly showing up here or there. Another member of the thrush family that likewise will make this eastward shift is the varied thrush, another one that we may show up in backyards and feeders every year, one or two, maybe every yeah. other year. Well, we'll get a few in Wisconsin.
So, Greta, you had a fun find there, because you're usually not going to see that bird in the Fish Creek area for sure. Well, let's take another call. Mike in Lodi, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, Larry. You and your guests. I have a question about the North American cuckoo bird. I used to see a lot more of them in my area, in my yard, but it seems every year there's less and less. What do they eat? What kind of eaters are they? And where do they winter at?
Very good question. Cuckoos are birds that, again, populations have been declining. And their main food is caterpillars, especially some of the larger ones. And it's been known for decades that their populations will shift with caterpillar outbreaks, especially in springtime, the tent caterpillars. So first of all, the numbers that we might see in any one area can change from year to year with the abundance or scarcity of the food supply. So when you get a caterpillar outbreak somewhere in another state, they may actually move. And how they know that, we're not sure. But they certainly move with that available food supply. A reason for the decline is really that they're one of the long-distance migrant songbirds. They've got a long migration. They're down in South America. So Colombia, Ecuador, Bolivia. In fact, this past winter, I was in Bolivia. We had a sighting of yellow-billed cuckoo all the way down there. And the longer you fly and your distance between your summer ground and winter ground, the more hazards they are. So that seems to be related to the declining population. So it requires more partners in conservation all the way from here, all the way through South America to keep those birds going. The other problem with cuckoos is they're one of the larger songbirds, but they're also incredibly secretive. If you know the calls, you'll hear them out there, but they have this habit of just sitting still in a tree, usually a real dense tree like a maple, where they're middle to upper part of the canopy. So they're higher up, they're in these thick leaves, and since they're looking for something slow and sluggish like a caterpillar, they'll just sit there. And I've stood by trees where you can hear them and you can stare up in those leaves for a long time before you can even find them, and sometimes not at all. So
what do they sound like?
It's kind of a little chuckling type call. I'm not going to try to even imitate it. If anybody's interested in calls, a really good website is All About Birds. It's the Cornell University site. You can just go there, type in a search for the yellow-billed or black-billed cuckoo, and you'll pick them up. And it'd be worth in summertime if people want to distinguish between the two, if they're hearing one in the neighborhood. Also, the name cuckoo, it is not related at all to the Eurasian cuckoo species. So the ones that for the cuckoo clock is designed after and found throughout Europe and a number of species throughout Europe and Asia, that's a completely separate family. It's just a transplanted name for the few species we have here in the Americas. So we have the yellow-billed and black-billed cuckoo in the United States, mangrove cuckoos further south, a couple other species as we get into the tropics.
There we go. And Tyler found zip down to the yellow-billed cuckoo here, and let's see what that sounds like.
A little bit of a cooing, and then in the song, it'll be a little bit more rolling, a little more chatty. They tend to have a little bit more complexity to their true song than the black-billed cuckoo does. So those are the two species. Oh. And you'll hear them in summertime from the middle or an upper part of these trees, as I say, sometimes pretty hard to spot. So that's why it's really worthwhile to know the songs.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Let's go to Superior in Duluth. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Larry, you always have such good shows. Yesterday, while walking on Minnesota Point along Lake Superior, my friends and I saw at least 14 golden eagles that were perched in pine trees and flying in the sky, and I was wondering if they were migrating or fishing, or if you had any thoughts as to why there were so many together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good question. First of all, my guess is that those are immature bald eagles. The golden and bald eagle, those are the two eagles we have in the Americas, and in the United States anyways, and bald eagle has really made a tremendous comeback in Wisconsin. We've got over 1,500 nesting pair just in the state. And in wintertime, wherever there's open water, you may find eagles. If we really freeze up, a lot of ours shift over to the Mississippi River, down toward Missouri, again, depending on the amount of open water. Also, as the winter becomes more severe, they concentrate below the dams on the Wisconsin and Mississippi River. So the colder the winter, the better the eagle watching is. And, of course, in January you have Eagle Days out of Prairie du Sac, Sauk City, and Mississippi has some events along the river there. Golden eagles, we've been doing some surveys in Wisconsin because we do find there is a population that comes off of the western plains and out into western counties of Wisconsin in the Driftless area. It tends to be a bit of a concentration site from the Mississippi River over toward, the Nisida Wildlife Area. They conduct a winter survey, and the fellow who coordinates it makes sure that there's a training session so that people know the plumage of the immature and adult golden eagle and the various immature plumages of the adult of the bald eagle. So bald eagles, they don't attain the white head and tail until they're about 4, 5, 6 years old, usually around 5 years. And they go through a number of immature plumages, and there can be some similarity in the look of them. They're about the same size, and when you've got that mix of the real dark brown blackish feathers with the white intermixed, they can be a little bit difficult to distinguish. Golden eagles tend to be out on the prairies and open country taking upland game, where the bald eagle is a fisher in the main part. So open water where there are fish available, they can snatch off the surface of the water. However, they also will be scavengers. We've seen them on roadkill deer, things like that. And as a little aside, that's why Ben Franklin did not want it as a national symbol, because it was well known as a scavenger. He wanted the turkey, of course.
There you go. Thank you so much for that call. We will turn next to Paul in Tomahawk. Paul, hello.
Hey, good morning. We also up here in Tomahawk have been seeing some evening grosbeaks for the first time in many, many years.
Oh, good for you. Yeah, normally they're found if they come into Wisconsin, those northern tier of counties. But it seems as if maybe there is a little bit bigger influx that they're scattering around the state a little more. Lucky you.
We've also, we have one lone grackle that is still visiting our feeder, which is the first I've ever seen this late in the year?
Not entirely unusual. When we do our Christmas bird counts, red-winged blackbirds, grackles, and the cowbird, which are all in the blackbird family, can be found. Not in huge numbers. The vast majority of them head out, but especially in the central southern part of the state, outside of the forested areas, we'll pick them up occasionally. So there can be some pretty good flocks in the remaining, especially if there's, say, standing corn, or if there's no snow, the waste corn and grains out there and the wild food, they're still pretty available. I'm always looking at, during the Christmas bird count, to try to add a red-winged blackbird or a cowbird or occasionally even a grackle to the list.
There you go. Thank you, Paul. Aaron in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Yes, yeah, so I'm just a local birder in the Madison area, and I just like to make a shameless plug for the website called ZBird.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys have talked about it on the program yet, but it's a website that's run by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and they use it's a citizen science program that anybody can contribute bird sightings to, and they use that data for conservation efforts and. That kind of thing. So even if you're just sitting in your house and you're watching your birds in your backyard, you can upload, you know, how many birds you see and what species to this website, and all of that will get recorded and potentially used for conservation efforts.
Yeah, good point.
And also if you're doing the Christmas bird counts around, you can submit all that data to there too. So it's a really good website and resource for conservation. It's completely free to sign up, and it's just a great thing to do if you're out bird watching.
Yeah, yeah, Aaron,
thanks.
Good
thanks
point.
For adding that. Yeah, one of the big times in wintertime is the backyard backyard bird count. So people are encouraged to both participate, to look at what's in their backyard at that time, that's in February, and then also to submit the data electronically to eBird. And it's the kind of the ultimate crowdsourcing for bird watching data. So it's really nice that we get this information of sightings of literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people who are watching birds out there and doing so all across the country. You can even do things like, say, look at a hummingbird, the ruby-throated hummingbird, and watch as the sightings come in and see as they hit the Texas and Gulf Coast in early spring, and then as the populations and sightings occur throughout the southern states as they move further north, and you'll see where they're found during the nesting season and retreat. And they'll actually do it as a little video clip where you'll see them just come, and they'll just mushroom spread around, and they'll disappear with the months. It's just amazing because you just have so much data there. And
that's really neat.
You're relying on anybody who's got an interest in birds and a pair of binoculars just to submit the data, or a backyard bird feeder.
Thank you, Aaron. Appreciate the call very much. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. Always great to have him with us. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Larry Mueller, and have with me birding expert Bill Volkert. Always great to have him stop by. Questions, comments, maybe an experience to share? Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us your question or maybe your bird photo at ideas@wpr.org. And open lines get you on pretty quick. Let's go to Jim in Oshkosh. Jim, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Good morning.
Morning.
I feed blue jays peanuts in their shell. And sometime around April, they lose interest in them.
Mm-hmm.
And don't show any further interest in them until the end of September or October. And my question is why?
Uh-huh. Seasonal food source, huh?
Yeah.
I think it's just simply that all of a sudden you get such a flurry of natural food that's available. They just have so many choices. So as you get into the fall time, things start to thin out a little bit. For winter time, it's a really handy food source for them. But as you say, by April, you start to get insect hatches. You start to get some plant growth. And so with that, just the native food starts to become available. Also, the birds may shift a little bit very locally from the bird feeder, where they're not, they're just looking for a place to feed conveniently, to a nest site. And so with native natural food available in such abundance, and perhaps starting to move in on a nesting territory, they're taking advantage of other foods.
There you go. Thank you so much, Jim, for that call. And Tyler, maybe you can find the sound of an immature eagle, because we had Kenneth in Janesville wanted to hear that. And in the meantime, we'll take a look at some other things. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Mark in Stevens Point has something for us. Let's go there.
Yeah, you guys talked earlier about that late snowstorm, and being that I'm a hunter, I keep an eye on the woodcock population.
Mm-hmm.
I did not see one woodcock through the spring or fall this year. Usually you can hear them peeping up in the air when they're flying right at dusk and stuff.
Right.
And I didn't see anything this year. I was really surprised by that.
Woodcock is another one that we've had over the last two decades, somewhat of a decline in the population. There's been a number of investigations, not quite sure what the cause of that is. The woodcocks usually can do fairly well even with snow on the ground, because they'll be probing for their food, so the ground really didn't freeze all that much. And I find them down, say, in the wetlands or along the edges of small creeks where they can always retreat or move to be able to feed. What the long-term trend is, or what the seasonal impact was from the April storm added to that, I guess that still is a little bit of a question. But yeah, it's a bird that I've noticed over the last 20 plus years. I don't see as frequently as I used to. So we definitely have a bit of a decline in the population. And what usually happens as bird populations decline, they first thin out and disappear from the fringe of the distribution of the population. So what is marginal habitat, and sort of retreat to the core area. So when you've got plenty of them, you've got high populations in prime habitat and others that spread out and sort of spill over into areas. As they contract, you'll start to lose them around those poor marginal quality habitat areas first, and sort of retreat toward the core, and then that number starts to become depressed. Keep your eye on them, see if it doesn't come back.
I think Tyler might have an immature bald eagle that Ken in Janesville wanted to hear. Let's see if we can get that up.
That's all it is. Just that little sharp chirping almost. And it's such a large and majestic bird, it's really kind of a wimpy call. I've actually noticed in movies, and I'm sure I've heard other people comment on this too, they've occasionally shown a bald eagle and then play the loud screech of the red-tailed hawk, which sounds a little more fierce, a little bit more aggressive. And people have dubbed that in because that just doesn't really carry, and I guess people wouldn't associate it with the bald eagle, but that's all they do. That's their call.
You mentioned raptors. John and Baldwin wondered why peregrine falcons migrate, but other raptors don't.
Good question. Well, among our raptors, a lot of them do migrate. And that has to do with food availability, obviously. And so it's the rodent population, which, like the lemmings up in the Arctic, will also go up and down. So our little meadow voles and deer, mice, things like that, do have population cycles. And as we get more accumulating snow, you may have an abundant rodent population, but they're less accessible. And so some of these birds will move. We've actually had data of banded birds, both among kestrels and the red-tailed hawks, where the same individual stuck around in Wisconsin one winter and then migrated quite a distance another winter. So they move with food. Well, peregrine falcons are looking for birds in flight. Well, most of your food is migrating south, so they tend to move with that. I have had sightings of peregrine falcon in winter. It's not real common, but some will stick around. We also have another interesting migrant among our raptors, and that's the rough-legged hawk. That is a bird that breeds way up north with the snowy owl. They come to Wisconsin in the wintertime. This is considered down south. I had a nice sighting of a dark-faced rough-legged hawk the other day, and they like the big open country again, so the large windswept areas, stay away from the forested sites. And we can get every year a fairly good movement of rough-legged hawks in Wisconsin. And if we get heavy snow accumulation, they'll start to head south into Illinois and other states.
Let's turn to Dave in Friesland next. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about pileated woodpeckers.
Yeah.
We have a woodland, maybe 60 acres, and I was wondering how many birds would you expect on a property that size, and do pileated woodpeckers stay through the winter?
Yes, they are non-migratory, so if you've got them in a neighborhood, they will remain, so they don't move out. And 60, 100 acres or so, I would say your population are probably one breeding pair. Yeah. Smaller woodlots, you may have just an individual that may not even be successfully mating and nesting there, may not be enough food, but you might have a young bird that moved out, is looking for food there and take advantage of what resources it can find. That's a population that we actually have been seeing an increase in. And the main reason for that is the growth of our forests. Big woodpecker like that, and they're the size of a crow. That is our largest woodpecker. They need big trees and abundant food sources. And they really go to the heart of the matter. They will excavate right into the middle of these big dying trees to go after the large ant colonies that live within them. And so as our forests have been maturing, the trees have been getting bigger, trees are dying out. And with that, we've actually been seeing an increase in the pileated, or also called pileated, woodpecker throughout Wisconsin. So it's becoming a more common sight.
Yeah, that's great news.
But
Dave, thank you.
Big forests.
Yeah, yep, they do indeed. Thank you for that call. Let's go to Jim in Cleveland next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a question about a bird we saw early this spring. For the first time, we saw scarlet tanagers. There were two of them at our feeder. And we never...
Nice sight.
Yeah, that's a brilliant colored bird, isn't it? Just spectacular
right.
to see.
Right.
They usually come back in early May. The population is seems to be fairly well. I get some pretty good sightings throughout Wisconsin. The one difficulty with a bird like this, they've got what are really spectacularly brilliant tropical colors. And like a lot of tropical birds, they can afford to have those bright colors if they're in dense foliage. And so they tend to move up into the treetops. If you know the calls and songs of them, you'll find that in large mature forest stands, they'll be up there overhead. In springtime, the casual bird watcher may get the sight of a bird that's that brightly colored. They'll see it, then they seem like they all just disappear. They're just moving into those mature maple forests. And it's a fairly common bird. It is also a long-distance migrant. They're going to South America, and this is a bird that I've sighted all the way down to Peru.
Wow.
It's the southern edge of its range, but they will get down all the way there in the upper Amazon.
So, Jim, you had a nice sighting there. Thank you so much for that
call.
Always
a great bird, and watch for it next spring. Yes, yeah. They'll be back.
On to Dan in Madison next. Hi, Dan.
Yes, I was wondering about absence of absence of hawks and different birds that would feed on the rabbits and different little voles that are eating my garden plot.
Mm-hmm. Well, rabbit is a pretty good size prey item for most birds, and the two main predators on rabbits are going to be great horned owl and the red-tailed hawk, so some of the bigger of our raptors. Those are the main ones that are going to be really tackling something of that size. All the other hawks and owls tend to go after smaller prey items, mostly the rodents and some of the little ones like screech owls and our kestrels. In summertime, they'll go after large insects, grasshoppers and crickets. So rabbit is a pretty formidable prey item. You need a pretty big bird to go after something like that. Out west, the golden eagle will take them. But if you think about the breeding potential of a rabbit population, there's no way that your predators are going to keep up on them. And so they will take advantage of the food. They'll kind of skim the surplus off, but they're not going to control that population. They'll cycle independently of the predator population. But that's really the main thing. And great horned owls, they have a very unusual habit. Rabbit is a pretty big thing to lift off the ground and fly up into a perch to kill and to dispatch there and take apart. So to lighten the load, they'll decapitate them.
Yeah.
And I remember one winter waking up, I looked at my bird feeder, and here was something unusual and brown that I could not identify laying down by the bird feeder. I got my binoculars. It was a rabbit head. It took off with everything else. So the spilled seed brought in the rabbit. That also brought in the owl. He had a meal, and he left the head behind.
I had a red tail on my way back to my office, my other office. A red tail had taken a rabbit and was dining on it right next to the sidewalk.
Yeah, sometimes a little hard to get up in a tree with something that big, so they'll have to thin out the food.
Interesting.
Thin out their load a little bit.
Excuse me, I've got a little raspiness today. David and Madison emailed to say he typically has a mix of sparrows, finches, chickadees, and downy woodpeckers. Despite the bounty of food items this year, he's hardly seen anything. He hasn't seen any evidence of predatory birds in the neighborhood. Is this a trend or not?
I think the main factor here is that we just don't have snow cover. There's just so much available, accessible food out in the countryside. The birds aren't really forced to the feeders. So just wait a little bit. We get some snow accumulation. It is not a direct relationship to the number of birds. I think we've got a pretty abundant winter bird population. Just they're not really hard-pressed yet. They'll show up.
Christy had a great story about a wild or chickens chasing away squirrels from her bird feeder. We can talk about that a little bit later on. But Bill Volkert, our guest today, back after the news. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bill Volkert, retired DNR educator and naturalist. Always fun to have Bill come by. Questions about birds, maybe some in your area, maybe you've got an experience to share. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you want to post a wildlife bird picture, we'd love to see that too at ideas@wpr.org. Bob in Franklin has a question or comment. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, I was in Monroe County last week and I saw a large bird. A black bird that I thought was a vulture.
Mm-hmm.
But when it was flapping its wings, I noticed that it had like a white bar going along the length of the wings, kind of like an Oreo cookie.
What could that be?
It had the head of a vulture. It was maybe a little bit more like a crow.
Okay.
Or a hawk.
Well, vultures, they've all disappeared out of Wisconsin by this time of the year. So things get a little tough for them. They're heading south. So I had a very large vulture rooster on my house all summer long the last few years now, and yeah, they've all disappeared a good month ago. As a real distinctive stripe along the wing, I'm not thinking of anything. First thought was immature bald eagle. It's more of a sort of speckled white throughout the wing and flight feathers. So not a real distinctive bar.
Somebody else may have a thought on it, but nothing's coming to mind for me.
And rough-legged hawk, that's the dark and light band across the end of the tail, not on the wing so much. You will get a little bit of banding in that wing, but it's not, say, a real distinctive. That would be the other possibility, light phase rough-legged hawk.
Well, it was pretty far away, so
okay.
I don't know if my description is very clear.
It still could
take a
have
look
been.
At the immature, the light phase rough-legged hawk. And sometimes for these larger birds, as they're flying, if they're flying away from you or waiting from the bank quite right, you're not always getting a complete, say, profile view of the colors. So oftentimes I have to wait for a bird to fly a little bit and to turn and move so you get a decent angle to be able to see everything. That would be a guess of mine.
All right, there we go. Thank you so much, Bob. Let's go to Paul in Kenosha. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I found a Canadian goose in my backyard without a head. A spread eagle out just laying there one morning, and you had mentioned about an owl taking the head off of a rabbit to make it lighter. I'm wondering if I actually asked a friend of mine who's kind of an outdoorsman, and he said that it was probably an owl that did that.
That is possible. I mean, it's certainly, say, his M.O., taking off the head. That is a huge prey item for great horned owl. Though I actually read in the literature a number of years ago about great horned owls, somebody observed them where the turkeys get up in the trees for their roost, would actually land on them, kind of ride them down to the ground, digging their talons in and trying to take something as big as a turkey. So possible. That's probably the only thing I can think of. Coyote would, which is a more common predator, especially for, say, an injured goose to take it out, would drag the whole thing away. Wouldn't leave something like that behind. Maybe you had a really bold or desperate owl that came down, was able to grab that and realize he couldn't handle it. Bit of a mystery, can't say for sure, but it's possible.
I've told this story, but it's been a long time. A Canada goose in the wintertime, we were living on Lake Monona in Madison, and there was a little bit of open water, and so there were some geese, and a goose was standing on the ice just next to the water, and an eagle came down and killed the goose.
Spectacular.
It was a spectacular sight, and started feeding on it, fed on it. Fed on it for a while and then left. And then later, here comes a red fox across the ice. Came over and ate on the same goose, and it left. And then finally, there were some crows that came down.
Picking up his left.
I didn't want to walk over to that open area, but it was quite a sight. And there probably wasn't very much left of that goose by the end of the day. That happened over the course of several hours.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Really, really cool sight.
Canada goose is a big prey item, and they're also very wary. So that's usually something that's not easily taken by either mammals or large birds of prey. Oftentimes these are birds that may be already injured or having some problem, or for an eagle to take it, he just got lucky. He came in at a steep angle, came in fast before the goose could react.
It was quite a sight.
It's not the kind of thing they catch normally.
Paul, thanks again. Let's go to Louise in Wauwatosa next. Hi, Louise.
Hi, thank you. I saw, I believe, what was a great blue heron next to the Menominee River in Wauwatosa. I saw it both sitting and flying, and the wingspan was enormous, and the wings were really just a beautiful blue color. Is it late for that kind of a bird to be hanging around this area?
Well, yes and no. It is certainly late for the vast majority of great blue herons. They've all taken off as water starts to freeze up. And also as the water temperatures cool down, the fish get a little more sluggish. So if you're a sight feeder, which they are, if the fish aren't that active and moving around, it's a little hard to catch anything. However, we tend to get great blue herons on Christmas bird counts almost every year, somewhere especially in southern Wisconsin, where the water is open and where there may be spring-fed creeks where it doesn't freeze over. I've had them on Christmas counts. I've had them in the dead of winter. There's always a few, and it's kind of a trade-off. Do you build up energy and fly a good distance south to a new area to escape the winter, or do you hold on to that energy and just stay right here and see if your luck is going to hold out and there's always going to be some open water and food available? So it's certainly not common as we get this late into the year, but it's also not impossible. We do pick them up periodically.
All right, there we go.
Good sighting.
Yeah, thanks, Louise. Appreciate it. And John in Madison, your turn. Hi, John.
We always go to St. Germain every year for vacation the end of July, first part of August. And we almost, a year ago there was 5 eagle's nests on the lake. This year there was like 1. You usually see osprey around there. I didn't see a single one this year. Plus, the nests were empty. Is that due to food sources? Also, just I don't know if you mentioned raptor rescue. I'll take it. The answer's off the air.
All right. Thank you,
sure.
John.
Well, overall, statewide, bald eagles are doing extremely well. So I think this is more of a local phenomenon that the pairs that were nesting right there where you were vacationing in summertime, perhaps they shifted or moved the territory. But overall, it's not like there's a widespread decline in eagle populations. It's quite the opposite. So I think it's very local. And I think this is the same thing that I oftentimes find from people when they look at just their backyard bird feeder and wonder, well, has the whole statewide population of something gone up or gone down because of what they're seeing in their backyard? That's not a good indicator of what's happening across the whole larger area. So osprey populations are also doing fairly well. They have not recovered or climbed quite to the way the eagles have. And where eagles and ospreys are found together, sometimes the eagles will be a little more dominant. And we've seen them actually move them off of their nest sites. The raptor rescue, that is Marge Gibson taking the, especially yeah. specializes in bald eagle recovery and rehabilitation, as well as other raptors. And she's a real specialist with those, does a marvelous job. And of course requires permits, not just to keep any bird, which they're all federally protected. You can't do that. But especially when it comes to bald eagles and additional federal regulations, she's got licenses to be able to do that. And DNR, if they take in any of those birds, they go right there. Because they're the specialists to be able to help get them back in and determine if there's a chance to return them to the wild.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it. Mark in Goose Pond Sanctuary in Arlington. It's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Mark. How's it going?
Good. Hey, here's the question I got for you. First, the situation. We've got our feeders out there, and we've got host finches with conjunctivitis.
Ah, yes.
And we found out, we just purchased some, but I was wondering if you knew any more information about them. We purchased from Wild Birds Unlimited some Eagle Clean antimicrobial product protection feeders. There's a patent pending on them, but it sounds like it's going to help reduce the disease. But are there other feeders out there like that? Or have you ever heard about that before? This is new to us.
No, it's new to me, too. I appreciate you calling in and sharing that. The only other advice I have is for the tube feeders, and it seems that the conjunctivitis is spread along kind of the modified feathers, like the eyelashes of the birds. So when they've got to get their bill into there to find that, that tends to hang around the feeders and can spread. So it's an eye disease that's spread among especially the house finches, and a few of the other finches have been known to pick that up. So the best thing to do is either let's see what happens with this new type of feeder to see if that helps reduce it. Or what I would also recommend is periodically as people fill their feeders, and this would be true of any of them, when they get low every so often, bring them in the house, thaw them out, get the waste food that may have accumulated in the bottom and that sits there, soak them in warm water with a little bit of bleach, do a disinfection. So this is a good chance to be able to keep it clean. We all like to attract the birds close to the house and be able to enjoy them, but there's always a chance of spreading of diseases, whether it's salmonella in the bird droppings or whether it's conjunctivitis. My analogy is it's kind of like a kid with a cold or the flu going to school.
Yeah.
You're concentrating the birds there, so you want to keep it clean. We can't keep the birds at home that shouldn't go to the feeder if they're ill, so you got to keep your bird feeding station clean. So with that, a little sanitation is really important.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it. Lisa in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Lisa.
Yes, I have a suggestion for a bird with the black with the white bar.
Yes, please.
I know it's way out of its territory, but out west they have mockingbirds, and they have that very distinctive, they're one of my favorite birds. There's solid blue-black with that white bar across their wings, and it's not visible until they fly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a possibility.
That's a possibility. Yeah.
I thought he was talking about a slightly larger bird than that, but it's closer than anything I've come up with so far. Thank you.
That's great. Thanks, Lisa. Appreciate it. And Ruth in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you next. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I had a pair of indigo buntings on my deck this summer. They only came once, but it was really nice to see.
Aren't they fun? They're just such a brilliant blue color bird. Such it makes a blue jay look kind of dull by comparison. This is another bird that is somewhat like the scarlet tanager's behavior. I hear a lot of people who see them in springtime for a week or two, maybe. They are tropical migrant. They're coming up from Central America. That's where they are right now. Is when they arrive here, as we're getting into that early April, early May, there isn't a lot of natural food available yet, so they're really drawn to the feeders. And I've had a lot of people ask me over the years, where do they all go to? Well, they're hitting the feeders because it's readily available food, but as soon as we get a bit of an insect hatch out there, they take advantage of that and just disappear. And like the scarlet tanager, they're up in the trees. Also, the blue is not a pigment. It's not a true blue color within the feathers. It's a reflected light.
Oh.
So the indigo bunting, the intensity of the blue, if he's down at the feeder and you got the light to your back, just glows a deep indigo blue. If he's sitting up on a tree branch or in a wire and you got the light from behind you, he looks black. And so a lot of people will just drive right by or walk by indigo buntings. If they're at the feeder then in early spring, you can't miss them. But they're in the neighborhood throughout the summertime. There again, it's really important to know the songs. He's got a real rapid up and down two-note call. And if you know that, you'll find out they're all over the neighborhood, especially where you've got a little bit of forest. But they're usually not seen that much throughout the summertime. So good for you to be able to find them in summertime. Nice backyard bird.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Ruth. Yeah, appreciate it. Rose in Watertown, your turn.
Oh, I'd like to photograph a owl, and I'd like to know where, if there's a website that lists the recent sightings.
So where do we go to photograph a snowy owl? Roses in Watertown, and she's not too far from potentially some spots.
Right. The DNR website, Ryan Brady is maintaining that one. He's up in Ashland, and he's got the kind of the tally of the totals as they're coming in. So it'll give you the number of birds we've now sighted in the state and the primary counties where we're finding them, but it's not specific locations. To up your odds, I would go to areas where we tend to see them more common. I would take a trip into that Central Sands of Wisconsin, do a little driving around there.
What about eBird? Would eBird have...
eBird would be another site that you could go to, yes, and you could take a look there to see where specific sightings have come up and take a look for that. Like any of these birds, keep in mind, especially these owls, they're coming down because they're stressed. And oftentimes the young ones come first. The adults hang on to the territory in the Arctic. And so these are birds that may be inexperienced. They've probably never even seen a human before. And they may be under stress. So be very considerate here in trying to get your picture. Don't be chasing that bird around or approach it too closely just to get that great photo. Get a bigger lens. And we also have to be careful that if we have a bird that is, say, near a population center, that we don't have somebody trying to photograph it every half hour, that the bird is getting chased and then keeping it from being able to do its hunting and get the food it needs. So a little bit of birding ethics and consideration for your photo subject is certainly wise to keep in mind.
Yeah, that's great. And I was thinking of Judith Sears Poisson. I've got a nice photo, gave me a gift of a photo of a snowy that she took, and it's a really nice thing to have.
Well, the nice thing about snowy owls is since they grow up in the Arctic and really have no contact with people, when they get down here, they also don't have a lot of fear of people.
Yeah.
So they can be quite approachable. We just have to be careful that we don't have such approaches to them, either the frequency or disturbance that goes with it, that keeps them from trying to find their food.
And just to go back to Christy earlier, just before our news break, I mentioned her. She had emailed, she has a wild bird feeder in her chicken yard, and the chickens enjoy when the birds knock seed to the ground, but so do the squirrels, and her sweetest hen will not tolerate a squirrel attempting to steal stray seed, and she thinks she keeps one eye on that area and makes a game out of chasing squirrels.
That's just a bold chicken.
Yeah. Because actually, someone called in once to talk about a squirrel eating on the ground next to a bird underneath a feeder and suddenly jumped and attacked and caught the smaller bird, the songbird.
That's very unusual for it to do.
And ate it. Right there. Yeah, squirrels will eat
Well, there's always those surprises in nature. It's certainly not common whatsoever, which is why it's an outstanding story. But, yeah, unusual things do happen.
What about unusual species in the state that we haven't talked about maybe that you've seen or heard of?
Yes, I mentioned at the outset, Hammond's flycatcher. That's almost puzzling to me what a flycatcher would be doing here in the wintertime. Not only it's a western bird, probably the first state record for Wisconsin, but what is it doing here at this time of the year, and especially since we've had an early freeze-up? It's got to be under a little bit of stress out there. but it seems to be getting by. The other one that is really quite surprising are some of the very late season sightings we have of the rufous hummingbird. This is a western hummingbird, but they show up in Wisconsin in the latter part of fall and even in early winter. I actually took a drive to some friends who had one in their backyard. I saw the report when it first came up. I just let it go. And then when I saw something much later on, it'd been there for almost a month, I thought, well, I'll go up and see it. I went right on November 13th when we had the freeze up and the bird had disappeared. But it stayed around that late into almost middle of November. And think about a little hummingbird. What's he doing in Wisconsin as we get into November and still hanging in there? I think some of these birds have a physical ability here that we haven't even yet completely comprehended. You would have thought that was a bird that would have long died a long time ago. Interesting, we go back about 25, 30 years. The first couple of sightings of these really late season hummingbirds, there were people who were so desperate to help them, they tried to capture them, make an arrangement with an airline to fly it down to Florida or the Gulf Coast. And these were actually done a few times. And eventually the biologist said, well, that's probably more stressful than leaving the bird out. And you may be surprised, they actually do this fairly often and quite regularly. So, I missed the sighting of the rufous hummingbird this time. But, surprising that he stuck around that late in the year.
Tim from Stevens Point emailed to say he's a big fan of the song In the Spring of the Catbird. He finds it interesting how as the season moves along, the song changes.
Yes.
We've kind of talked to him. He normally has best success with black sunflower seeds as the main food source for sparrows, nuthatches, and squirrels. He's also been experimenting with suet feeders. Any advice on suet would be appreciated.
Well, it comes in a number of different forms. You can use it just as the drippings off of ground beef or bacon. Watch a little bit with the bacon because it has a fairly high salt content for a lot of it. Also, you can get the suet cakes, or you can go right to the butcher, what is cut off, the tallow, and put that out. That works fairly well. I guess the best hint I would have, if you want a variety of birds, offer a variety of food. They've all got different diets, so a nice feeding station with different offerings, that'll certainly help round out the chances. Also, look at your yard right now for your landscaping. They need shelter. They need a place to hide and feel safe when they're coming and going for the feeder. So think about what else you could plant next spring to make it a little more bird-friendly. And I guess the last thing would be is take a look at your Christmas list. Nice field guide to help someone enjoy and identify birds. Good pair of binoculars or a bird feeder. I think that's always worthwhile to encourage somebody to be able to enjoy birds and maybe get into bird study and bird watching.
I've given bird seed as gifts.
Oh, yeah. Christmas. Once you get a feeder, somebody's got to fill that all the time. You bet.
I can remember my brother being quite happy with me when I presented him.
It can be an expense, you bet.
A nice bag of bird seed to go along with everything else.
For us, we consider all the bird seed in a year just the cost of living. that's just the way it goes. But as I say, you give somebody a feeder, now you're kind of stuck having to fill it all the time. So a 50-pound bag of seed would go a long way.
Bill, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's always great, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Larry. Always fun.
Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. He worked at Hork and Marsh for 27 years, did well over 3,000 talks while he was at Hork and Marsh. And he's, as you can hear as you listen to him, he knows a lot about birds. Well, tomorrow at 11, it's Garden Talk. Susan Carpenter, excuse me, from the UW Arboretum joins us. Thanks for listening.